Shalom and marhaba, and welcome to the Israel Policy Pod. I'm Neri Zilber, an independent journalist and policy advisor to Israel Policy Forum. The big diplomatic story of recent weeks, and arguably of our day, if not today, is the possibility of Israel and Saudi Arabia reaching a historic normalization and peace agreement through U.S. mediation. It's being talked about seriously due to the fact that the Biden administration is itself taking the matter very seriously. To help us make sense of the prospects for a deal, we have a very special guest with us this week, Saudi analyst Aziz Al-Lashian. Aziz holds a PhD from the University of Essex and is an expert on Saudi foreign policy, a fellow at the CPAD project at Lancaster University in the United Kingdom, and an associate fellow at the Carpo Center in Bonn, Germany. I'm delighted he's joining us for many reasons, but first and foremost, because we usually hear about Israel-Saudi peace from either the Israeli or American perspectives. We're now going to get the view direct from Riyadh. But first, a few thoughts from me. So it may be the dog days of August, but trust me, as many of you who follow these issues closely know, there are no vacations in and no vacations from Israeli politics, sadly. But it is summertime, so let's keep things simple. A quick state of play update regarding what's happening in Israel. So in terms of the judicial overhaul crisis, it's still here. Don't be fooled by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's U.S. media charm offensive the last 2 weeks, nor by the fact that the Knesset is on recess until October, which means no judicial overhaul legislation anyway. I still stand by what I said a couple of weeks ago regarding the quote-unquote five fronts approach. That is, the judicial overhaul crisis will be determined according to what happens on five distinct fronts in the coming weeks and months. On the streets, i.e. the protest movement, with the economy, inside the IDF, at the Supreme Court, and in Washington. Five fronts. There will be a lot more to say about the protest movement on the streets, the economy, and the IDF in the coming weeks, believe me. But for now, suffice to say that the protesters are still out in force, despite the dog days. Economic alarm bells are still going off, and the crisis inside the IDF due to the judicial overhaul is spreading in various ways. And for more on this particular issue, check out the recent podcast I recorded with Haaretz defense analyst Amos Harel. On a separate but related note, tensions are growing on the Israel-Lebanon border, and Israeli intelligence recently updated its assessment to say that the chances of renewed war between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon are at their highest since 2006, i.e., the highest since the month-long war they fought 17 years ago. But back to the judicial overhaul, the most immediate front to look for is the Supreme Court. There are a slew of petitions filed with the court related to the overhaul, but for our purposes, it's worth highlighting September 12th. That's when the Supreme Court will take up the petition against the reasonableness bill that the Netanyahu government rammed through the Knesset 2 weeks ago. This was the first bill as part of the overall judicial overhaul agenda, and a showdown is looming over this bill. Will the Supreme Court, for the first time ever, strike down a quasi-constitutional basic law? 15 justices, the entire court, will, for the first time ever, have to decide. Finally, the fifth front, Washington. There are a number of things Washington can do to influence events in Israel, whether by commission or omission. But let's be honest, a lot will depend on whether the Biden administration decides to indeed push ahead in the coming months with Israel-Saudi normalization. If done incorrectly, it'll bury any chances for not only the two-state solution and Palestinian statehood, but also Israeli democracy. Pretty high stakes, even for a breezy and languid August. For more insight, let's get to Aziz Al-Lashian. Hi, Aziz. Welcome to the Israel Policy Pod.
Hey there, Neri. It's good to be with you, my friend. Thank you very much for the invitation.
It's our pleasure, really, to have you on this week, Aziz. And a lot to discuss regarding the possibility of Saudi-Israel normalization, brokered by the U.S., of course. And just before we started recording, Dion Nissenbaum at the Wall Street Journal reported that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have agreed on the quote-unquote broad contours of a potential deal that they hope to strike in the next 9 to 12 months. U.S. officials, according to the report, are cautiously optimistic, but warned that many obstacles remain. In the words of one U.S. official quoted in the article, there's a work plan to explore the elements of what this would be and test the boundaries of what's possible. So Aziz, let's start unpacking exactly what this would be and what the boundaries may be as well, to this essentially a three-way deal between the U.S., Saudi, and Israel, and even possibly a 3.5 or 4-way deal if we take into account the Palestinian angle. But let's start off with the Saudi-U.S. component to this all. Best I can tell, these are the things Saudi Arabia wants from the U.S. Number one, a mutual security treaty, basically something like a NATO-level commitment where the U.S. commits to coming to the defense of Saudi Arabia if it's stacked. Second, a civilian nuclear program that the U.S. would monitor. And third, advanced U.S. weaponry. So first question to you, Aziz, is this to your mind roughly accurate in terms of what Saudi wants? And if so, what's the thinking or logic behind these specific requests?
Well, again, I just want to say again, you know, that it's a great privilege, really, to join you, Nira. I'm a very big fan of you, and just for the for the listeners, you're the only one that I have a notification on for Twitter and X. So you're the only individual, I would say.
You're much too kind. Yeah, yeah. Flattery will get you everywhere on this podcast.
So I hope you could give me more time to speak. No, that's because I said that.
we can go for 3 hours.
There you go. No. Thank you. I mean, I think when it comes to these demands, it's also worth reminding ourselves that these aren't official. You know, no Saudi official has come out and said anything. But there has been this kind of communication through media outlets that suggests that just like the U.S., you know, said that they're exploring these options. You know, this is also the Saudi approach of also exploring these options, seeing what can be attained. And seeing what their reaction will be. I think, in my opinion, conditions for normalization for Saudi has never been absent. In other words, I think Saudi has never said, or rarely said, especially from the 1970s onwards, that they've never said no to normalization with Israel. They've said, you know, but... You know, there's always a condition, but we have to do this, but we have to do that. And I think historically, it's always been the Palestinian issue. But I think from the Abraham Accords, that it played a particular junction in this triangulation of Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the U.S., or at least the square, you know, that you mentioned, this Saudi Arabia, Israel, U.S. and Palestine.
U.S.
Yeah, and Palestine. And I think, you know, at that point, it became clear that, listen, not only can you normalize with Israel, but there's something that you could get out of the United States from this too. So in some ways, the Abraham Accords kind of probably helped bring on board relations with the two GCC states, UAE and Bahrain. But in some ways, it also complicated the road towards Saudi because of the American component now.
I see.
So these demands, in my opinion, are just another layer of conditions that they've put. And Saudis don't say no normalization, period. They say yes, normalization, but 1, 2, and 3. And I think there's a lot of conditions set here. So we're just going to have to wait and see how this is going to play out.
Right. And we're going to get into the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council element, Saudi and its Arab neighbors as well. We're definitely going to get into the Palestinian component in just a second. But to your understanding, I mean, something like a mutual security treaty guaranteed by the U.S. or a civilian nuclear program, these are reasonable requests from Riyadh to Washington in terms of what Riyadh actually wants to see out of this?
Well, in my opinion, I think Riyadh knows this is very difficult to get. And that's the reason why they asked for it. You know, this is another way of maintaining that particular distance between, you know, with Israel, that it's not too far, but it's not too close at the same time. You know, and this is what the Saudi foreign policy has been towards Israel. It's always maintaining that safe distance that it wants to be in. So I think it knows that it's not that it's very difficult. But at the same time, I mean, if we look at this purely from a U.S.-Saudi perspective or a Saudi-U.S. perspective, I also don't think that this goes with, this is congruent with Saudi calculations. I mean, Saudi calculations now is that it's becoming more of a, you know, it's growing in agency. It's becoming more of a medium kind of power and is trying to be. Only recently, a few days ago, it hosted mediation talks.
That's right.
Between Ukraine and Russia, or a pathway, a principles, declaration of principles towards that, solving the issue in Ukraine and Russia. So, I think it is, and in the Arab summit not too long ago, I think 2 months ago, it also made clear that they're not going to be a platform of competition between different powers. And so I'm not sure if it wants to put itself underneath American security umbrella in the sense where it will kind of have to have its agency curtailed. You know, it's going, this is for a particular challenge. So this really begs the question, then why did they make these demands, especially this notion of alliances, I would say, because, you know, it's not working with what Saudi wants, but is that negotiable? You know, is the fact that, okay, you know, is there a particular kind of settlement that enables American obligation, but at the same time facilitates Saudi agency and being a middle power, and this positive neutrality that it's now a core of its foreign policy. So it's just difficult to see how they're going to fit and complement each other.
So this is an interesting point, because it gets me to my second question, which is the U.S. asks or requests of Saudi Arabia, other than, of course, peace with Israel. And we've heard reported that these are things like a commitment to fully end the war in Yemen, although ceasefire is held now for quite a while. We've also heard about curtailing relations with China, which alludes to what you said about Saudi wanting to be playing this kind of middle role. And we've also heard about U.S. request of Saudi to provide millions in aid, or perhaps billions in aid, to the Palestinian Authority. So again, does that strike you as something, say, reasonable that Saudi would be willing to accept as part of this overall grand bargain? Or, like you said, will this actually be an issue in terms of Saudi having to effectively choose, and very clearly choose, between the U.S. and China, which, according to the Wall Street Journal report, was a major component of this work plan?
Yeah. Well, you see, this is the thing. That's another element. I think, firstly, some of these things that you mentioned, these demands, these, if I'm not wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but they're coming from the Thomas Friedman piece. Is that accurate?
Thomas Friedman, mostly of the New York Times, the Biden Whisperer.
The New York Times piece
of late. Yes.
Yes. Okay. There you go. The Biden Whisperer. So, I mean, he gave, I think it's also good to contextualize what he said. Also, in addition to these things, so he gave an interview to the New Yorker. He also gave an interview to Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, D.C., and he kind of explained that these things were somewhat on the top of his head, that these demands, because I think personally, there was a lot of things that many people criticize him for, I mean, most of the commentary that I've seen was that, you know, it was just dismissive of some of these demands, that they were just, they just didn't speak to the reality of Saudi calculation, of U.S.-Saudi relations, of Saudi-China relations. So, you know, so it's important to just to remind ourselves that, you know, it was something that he kind of mentioned just at the top of his mind and kind of shared it. And I think he shared it to kind of have something on the coalition, to, because he did say this. He's like, my main intention is to break up the coalition in Israel.
Yeah.
So
we're going to get to that point in just a second as well.
So I'll, of course. So I think when it comes to Yemen, the situation against the Houthi rebels, you're right. There has been something that this is something that they've wanted, but this is something that they've always wanted. You know, the way these demands were kind of delivered, as if it was Saudi is constantly striving to get, you know, to use more force in Yemen or against the Houthis, when in fact they actually want to withdraw. You know, they actually want to de-escalate. It was the best term, I think, and hence why there is a ongoing process of negotiations now. So that's one thing. The Saudis already wanted what that demand was. The other aspect of China, and this is where I think is the most tricky part, because for Saudi Arabia now, whoever is following Saudi Arabia will see the immense amount of projects that Saudi Arabia is doing. And, you know, when you have the line that costs, what, $500 billion, you have the square, you have hexagon or octagon, you know, you have all these massive projects that Saudi Arabia is doing, in addition to investing in renewable energies, in addition to a lot of things. You know, Saudi Arabia needs oil rent still, you know, and still hasn't moved away from it. And this is precisely where, or the crux of Saudi-China relations, that it is very difficult to see Saudi Arabia moving away from the China, from the relations in China, or curtail the, or limit the relations with China, because it's just not likely. You know, the relationship with China means the lifeline for this vision that the Crown Prince himself has championed. And so, this it will be very wishful thinking. I just do not see, you know, Saudi Arabia moving away from its biggest oil
buyer.
You know, it's buying oil. It's the biggest. It's the most country that buys oil, and therefore, if it buys oil, it means the projects can continue. If it curtails that, then I don't think the projects will be finished on time, at least. So that's an issue.
So this is an interesting point that you raised, because it also came up in the Wall Street Journal report just now, that it's not, I suppose, just geostrategic ties between Saudi and China. It's also Saudi's role in the global energy market, and that the U.S. would seek at least some attenuation of global oil prices in return for this massive normalization deal, this overall normalization deal. And like you said, that could be prove fatal to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's overall vision, what's called Vision 2030, right?
Vision 2030. Yeah.
Vision 2030. So it's also, it's an interesting point that you raise, how far does Saudi actually want to move in the direction of this grand bargain if it actually jeopardizes MBS's overall vision for Saudi moving ahead. Enough foreplay. Let's get to the Saudi-Israel angle of this all. Obviously, Israel would receive a hugely coveted prize, peace with arguably the most important Arab country today, which could in turn open up further normalization deals with other major Muslim countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, and even Pakistan. It's a huge deal, which Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called just the other day a pivot of history. We can debate that, but let's ask this question. What does Saudi actually want from Israel? Is it just on the Palestinian issue?
Well, what it wants from Israel is that, yes, it wants concessions. And I think, you know, I think in the midst of all these discussions and this grand bargain and the negotiations and the speculation of this, there's a lot of things that have been overlooked regarding Saudi's position, not just as a Muslim country, et cetera. We've seen that a little bit. But, you know, the Saudi, where Saudi, what is happening in Saudi, what is happening in the region and the Saudi role that is being played out in the region now. You know, Saudi is becoming a regional leader. You know, there this comes against the backdrop or a time in the 2017, 2018 and 19, you know, just before COVID hit, where there was an immense amount of hyper-nationalism, where there wasn't any kind of regionalization taking place. And that was precisely a window of where Israel could have perhaps had a particular relationship with Saudi or a normalization with Saudi that didn't take into account other regional aspects. But now, Crown Prince Mohammed, he himself is actually becoming an Arab leader. And that is why there needs to be something significant on the Palestinian issue, which he can then base the legitimacy of the Saudi-Israeli relationship on. You know, he could, and this is actually the whole dance now that's taking place. You know what I'm saying? It's well, what kind of concessions are there? Some people say, well, there are gestures, freezing of settlements, and no promising of no annexation.
Right.
But if there's promising of no annexation, then what was the Abraham Accords for? So I suggest that it really wasn't about the Abraham, you know, the Abraham Accord wasn't that. Sorry, Nir, go on.
No, I was going to say that, yes, there's all kinds of talks about what Saudi will actually ask of Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And we're really talking about the West Bank and maybe Jerusalem, although that's also hard to imagine given the current political climate. And like you said, the Abraham Accords and specifically the Israel agreement with the United Arab Emirates, the stipulation on the part of Israel was that it would refrain from annexing the West Bank for reportedly 4 years. Now, the Abraham Accords were struck in 2020, so we're coming up to that deadline next year. And in Israel, it's kind of been reported anonymously, but Israeli government officials say, yeah, well, you know, we'll just reheat that meal.
Exactly.
And sell it to another Arab country again.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess the question is, would MBS, would the Crown Prince actually agree to something like that? Or would he need something a lot more significant from Israel on the Palestinian issue?
Yes, no, a lot more significant. I'm going to be shorter and more to the point now, a lot more significant. Because I think he's seen how the Abraham Accords played out. He's seen kind of how the leverage that the Abraham Accords couldn't induce on political matters. While some officials in the UAE, and while, with all due respect, they said that, no, this will give us leverage over Israeli policies. And clearly this hasn't happened. So from the doves of the Abraham Accords to now Abrahamic extremists and Ben-Gavir and Smodrich, the Abraham Accords was a framework that really didn't induce any leverage. I think the Saudi Crown Prince sees that and says, okay, that can't be played on me. That's not something that we could use, or that we could use to base the legitimacy of this. There has to be tangible conditions. I'm sorry, concessions. And the issue is, one of the things that, you know, Thomas Friedman said is that is it going to be something that preserves the two-state solution? And I'm not really sure, you know, what that would mean, because preserving, it's just perhaps another kicking of the can down the road. It's something that's going to have to facilitate normalization, or at least it should be. I'm sorry, facilitate a two-state solution rather than preserve it. You know, I think this is why there has to be a regional approach. You know, there has to be more harmonious input here and a regional input to this. But, you know, in short, I anticipate a very significant concessions. And the Saudis are not in a hurry. This is another issue. Saudis are not in a hurry to have normalization with relations with Israel.
Interesting. So you think this is more urgency on the part of, say, the Biden administration going into an election year, or
yes,
the Netanyahu government, given, well, everything going on in Israel these days?
Yes. Yeah. Well, yes. Firstly, I mean, the speculation towards Saudi-Israeli normalization is not new. You know, we could see the speculation in my research. We could see the speculation as a result of the Arab Spring. So it goes back in because it was the way in which people used to, the lens they used to explain the region was through a very polarized binary lens. It was the Shiites versus Sunnis. It was very much Iran versus Saudi Arabia. And then the question was, where does Israel fit in this? You know, where does Israel fit in this? Okay, well, they both have, you know, problems and security threats with Iran. Therefore, they must be on the same camp. And this is very unnuanced. Now, that in itself, I remember even early as 2014, Lieberman, who was then, I think, defense minister, said that, yeah, we will have relations with Saudi Arabia, open relations in a year to 18 months time. This was all the way back in 2014, you know, and it goes back again, and you could see these kinds of attempts. And I think what has changed is that before, Israeli politicians, particularly Netanyahu, wanted to associate himself and hint or speculate that there's something with the Saudis that's going to happen very shortly to gain political kind of support. Where I think now, I think with the current government and the way it's being it's on all the pressure that it's facing, it's really about alleviating pressure.
For
Netanyahu and the coalition. And they're kind of, you know, because what's very fascinating about this whole deal, this perspective here deal, this potential deal, is that there has to be something on the Palestinians. And the fact that this government isn't willing to make any concessions kind of instigated them or made them say, no, the Palestinians are never an issue, in order to avoid them being an obstacle towards normalization. So yeah, I think this is what's very fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I'll do you one better.
Okay.
That in the recent days, we heard Israeli Foreign Minister Eli Cohen give an interview actually to, I believe, an online Saudi outlet. And he basically said, yeah, we can talk about economic steps vis-a-vis the Palestinians. We're very much willing to improve their standard of living. Full stop. And then we obviously also saw Bibi Netanyahu in his interview earlier this week to Bloomberg say that the actual quote was, the Palestinian thing is brought in all the time. It's sort of a checkbox. You have to check it. You have to check it in order to say you're doing it. Is that what's being said in corridors? Is that what's being said in discrete negotiations? The answer is a lot less than you think. So you're saying Bibi Netanyahu is likely wrong, just given how Riyadh actually views the Palestinian issue.
Well, yes. You see, because firstly, then why didn't it happen if it was that small? Why didn't normalization happen? If it was that small, then why didn't normalization happen? And the other aspect of that, I think many people are underestimating the role that Palestine plays in the Saudi identity. In my opinion, I mean, I can't say this is the number one issue. Many people are you know, overly concerned or following it constantly. I don't think that's the reality in the entire region. But it's sort of like saying, you know, man that constantly shaves a lot, shaves their facial hair, but then if you ask them to take a pill to stop any facial hair growing ever, you kind of say, no, I don't want that. No, I don't want to have that choice. You know, it's something that, okay, that might be on the periphery, but it's at the same time, you don't want to let it go. You know, you don't want to let it go. You can't let it go, because the way Palestine is framed in Saudi discourses is very it's very interesting the way it's that, okay, no, King Salman hasn't yielded to the American pressure of normalization.
And in contrast to MBS, the Crown Prince, who is viewed as, well, I don't really care about the Palestinian issue at all, versus his father, who's a lot more traditional and quote unquote hardline vis-a-vis this particular issue.
Yeah. Well, you see, this is where I also disagree with that sentiment. The reason being, while that might be, that might be not wrong, because it's an inherent, inevitable generational issue, not a personal issue. The aspect is that, you know, there's a lot of things that are taking place in Saudi that wouldn't have taken place 10 years ago. There's a lot of concerts that take place. You know, there's a lot of issues, and main legitimacy is domestic. You know, so if it facilitated parties, if it facilitated concerts, if it's facilitating all these things, then it, you know, if the Crown Prince had the green light to do that, then I think he would have the green light to do what he thinks is best and normalize relations with Israel outside of a settlement with Palestine. But the reality is, I think even he came to the conclusion, the Crown Prince, that this is not in Saudi's favor. This won't be congruent with him. This won't be congruent with his legacy. And that's why there has to be something significant on the Palestinian issue, which is a foundation of legitimizing his legacy also with his relationship with Israel.
I see. Okay. That's very clear and to the point. And just on the issue of Saudi-Israel, from the Saudi perspective, do they actually believe this thesis that was put out, again, by Tom Friedman, but likely this is what the Biden administration actually believes as well, that a deal that includes significant concessions to the Palestinians would inevitably blow up the current far-right Israeli coalition, and that would inevitably lead to a new, more centrist coalition in Israel, maybe with Benny Gantz, etc., replacing Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. Is this how, to your mind, Riyadh views the political dynamics as well surrounding this deal?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm sure the government is following the political dynamics, but I'm not. That is absent somewhat. These kind of scenarios is absent in Saudi media, period. That's not being mentioned. What's being mentioned in the Saudi media is these speculations, the nature of these speculations. And also, I personally sense that they suspect over-politicization on Biden's end. You know, they sometimes ask these Saudi-based journalists or academics, and it's like, well, 2 weeks ago, he said that's very unlikely. Now Biden is saying, no, it's something that could happen. Why do you think that is? And, you know, it's clearly the question is, you know, nudging the person towards the elections. And they always conclude with the fact that the Palestinian issue is not something that they're willing to sacrifice on. So this is when it comes to Saudi media. The other aspect of Saudi discourse happening within Saudi is that, you know, they're following these protests. There's a lot of turbulence. Jenin, you know, turbulence in the West Bank. Personally, you know, I'm not sure if they're going delving deeper into the intricacies of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and all these scenarios that, you know, it's just going to make someone go crazy, to be honest, if they really try to follow it. You know, so I think when it comes to Saudi, personally, they have a principled position, and or you know, their position is just based on a principle, is that let this simmer, let's see what comes out of this, and then we could, you know, make the next move. Basically, what they have done is that they've put the ball in two courts, the American court and in the Israeli court. And they're the ones now that are sitting and waiting to see what comes out of this.
I see. Okay. It's a very interesting dynamic. Because I think you may be onto something, that the urgency coming out of Washington and Jerusalem seems very real, whereas the urgency coming out of Riyadh for this kind of deal maybe not existing in the same way, which brings me to the next question. From the Saudi perspective, right, there's also politics in Washington. And from Riyadh's perspective, is it easier to do this kind of deal with a Democratic administration that can whip up Democratic support on Capitol Hill? And by the way, also hand Joe Biden an election year foreign policy win? Or from the Saudi point of view, again, is it better to wait to see what happens next November? And maybe you'll get a Republican administration, i.e. Donald Trump. And then, you know, the contours of a future deal might be even sweeter with a lot less conditions.
Yeah. Well, you see, again, none of this has been mentioned, but I don't think they have to mention it. I think this is part of it's a vibe. And this is the situation here. Even in that meeting, there was someone that mentioned regarding the meeting about Cohen and that sense of urgency. There was a official that said, an anonymous official that said, you know, that listen, Saudi isn't really in a rush and isn't in a hurry, and it's not constraining itself to any kind of campaign horizon or 2024.
This was in the Wall Street Journal report.
Yeah, I see. This is also Elef, the thing that the Saudi-based,
foreign minister,
the London-based Saudi.
Right, Foreign Minister Cohen's interview.
Yeah. So here, Saudi, I think, in my opinion, senses the leverage that it has. And it's so interesting because I think Saudi, personally, has probably the most leverage it had for decades regarding an actual situation that could change things on the ground if the political landscape is better. And the reason being is that before, the history of this leverage was that, okay, Saudis, what are you going to do with the United States for them to pressure Israel to accepting something? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Are you going to cut oil just like what they did in 1973? Are you going to cut relations? King Abdullah, then Crown Prince Abdullah in 2001, early 2001 in the Second Intifada, he said, it's clear what you guys made, your decision as in the United States. It looks like we're going to have to just make our sovereign decision, go elsewhere, which was also kind of a threat that they're going to take their business elsewhere. But then it didn't reach to anything. Now, what's so fascinating is that the leverage has changed of not what Saudi does. It's actually what Saudi doesn't do, which is normalize. And this kind of changed the dynamics of leverage. So they're now sitting and they're saying, yes, let's see what our options. And we know that Israel is a bipartisan issue in the United States. And Israel wants to normalize relations, and this will get bipartisan support. So whether it is Biden, if we don't get it in Biden, American bipartisan support for Israel to normalize relations with Saudi isn't going to go anywhere. This isn't connected to Biden. This is now politicized, and the Saudis are the one in the seat where they could accept the offers or not. So I anticipate this continuing, and not only continuing, you know, this isn't, why would Saudi want to immediately remove this kind of power that they have now, this powerful position that they have now? I think Saudis are going to make the most out of the position that they find themselves in.
And it's a good point. And it's interesting that the Wall Street Journal report set out a timeline of 9 to 12 months, right? And this is actually a lot longer than what we'd been hearing in recent weeks, where it said, various reports said that, yeah, well, they want to cut a deal or conclude this deal by next spring, right? Because they want to do it well ahead of the general election in the States. And now it's looking like the contours of a deal and the time frame may be right up to almost election eve, late summer, early fall of 2024. So that's also, I guess, confirmation of the fact that at least one of the parties in this very complicated deal is in no rush to actually conclude the deal.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And One other thing I wanted to touch on, and you alluded to it earlier, is this, I guess, intra-Gulf, intra-GCC jostling, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
For stature, influence, prestige. As we mentioned, this is all coming 3 years after the Abraham Accords, first really between Israel and the UAE, and then Israel and Bahrain and Morocco and so forth. Just to remind our listeners, back then, the Emirates got a commitment from Israel, like we said, not to annex the West Bank, but also got a slew of commitments from the Trump administration for advanced weapons, like the F-35 stealth fighter, which, by the way, hasn't come through, again, for a variety of reasons. So going back to, I guess, what I alluded to earlier, does Riyadh almost have to ask for more just to show that it actually got more from Israel and from the United States as part of this normalization push?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of the times people look at the Gulf, the six Emirates, and then they think that they're all kind of one big state or some sort of one big confederation, and they all think alike, and they treat this very monolithically. The GCC is clearly not monolithic. You know, the UAE is very different than Saudi Arabia, very different than Qatar, than Bahrain, etc. And they have their own calculations. So that's important. And that became very evident and clear in many instances, but you could see this also in the position towards Israel. So with the Abraham Accords, I think what Saudi doesn't want to do is that it doesn't want to seem like a follower of the UAE trend.
Mm.
You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And because there's what I argue is that the UAE had an implicit or a tacit push to make a bid for regional leadership, for being this kind of state that is changing the boundaries and the landscape of the Middle East. And you could see this very much throughout Kushner's statements of, you know, we thank the then Crown Prince MBZ for his leadership of the region, of the new leadership of the region. You know, Bahrain also said, we thank the UAE for their leadership in this. So clearly there's an aspect of leadership here that I don't think Saudi will find too palatable if Saudi is going to follow or join the Abraham Accords. And by the way, note something very important that hasn't been said in this whole bargain, in the recent speculation. They never said, we're going to make Saudi join the Abraham Accords.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Abraham Accords wasn't mentioned anywhere in any of these new plans, etc. So Saudi is not, so therefore, Saudi is going to find a different pathway towards Israel. And that one will include something on the Palestinians. Concretely, at least this is from the tacit demands that were mentioned, and more concessions. I'm sorry, not more concessions, more concessions indeed, but something more. But I think what they are demanding, Neri, here is tangibility. You know, they're not demanding something of they're not demanding promises.
Gotcha.
You know, and I think they suspect they've seen this. You know, they've seen this. Okay, well, annexation, will it stop annexation? All right. From the UAE side, they said this will stop annexation. I think from the Israeli side, it was suspension of annexation, not really stopping it, but settlements can continue. As in, not can, but settlement. You know, it didn't stop. You know, is it? It didn't really deter the Israeli government from building more settlements. So I think Saudi is watching this and saw a particular sequence that it will find very frustrating if it made a deal that was based on promises. That okay, F-35s weren't given. Weren't given to UAE. Settlements still continued. Leverage over the kind of Israeli policies and behavior towards the Palestinians in the West Bank was limited. And I think they're sensing this and they're saying, I don't think it will be very congruent with what the Crown Prince wants for the region. By the way, there is a regionalization that Saudi Arabia is pushing for. You know, you hear his discourse. He's always talking about a prosperous region, a prosperous region. We want a prosperous region. And he's asking for more regional integration, which requires leadership, which is clearly, you know, a push that he is tacitly leading. And therefore, you know, this could hinder, right. hinder again, the regionalization effort and his image as a leader of this new Arab order that is being emerging here.
So basically, the Crown Prince doesn't want to cut a deal with Israel and the U.S., say, next March or whenever it might be, and then the very next day have an Israeli government do something crazy in Jerusalem or the West Bank.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Clearly. I mean, it's just not. I think they've gotten that insight. And to be honest with you, I mean, another thing about Saudi-Israeli dynamic here in relations is that, I mean, does Saudi Arabia need to really normalize relations with Israel? You know, what is normalization now? For the UAE, normalization was also a process of reaching many ends. But now it's becoming clear that normalization is an end to itself. You know, it's a political statement. You see Israelis coming here to Saudi Arabia indirectly because of the international events, et cetera, which Saudi cannot boycott. There is harmonious relations vis-a-vis Iran. You know, this is what I kind of theorize in my PhD and in the book that I'm writing, is that this passive form of cooperation, it's basically cooperating by getting out of each other's way, not by working towards each other. And, you know, there's another thing about this is that, I'm sorry, you wanted to say something, Nara.
No, I was just going to add, we probably should have mentioned this at the top, that Israel and Saudi already have fairly close but under the table ties in terms of security, intelligence, other avenues that have become fairly well known. So it's not like the Saudis and the Israelis don't have contacts as is. So your point is well taken. What does Saudi actually get out of this except for all the goodies from Washington?
Exactly. So, you know, and just one last thing quickly, this is now Saudi historically has had, you know, Saudi's relationship towards Israel has been kind of a result or a theme within the Saudi-American relationship. So it's different that this is now between two powers that are negotiating. You know, Israel is part of it. The Palestinians are part of it, but they're not the main ones. You know, and so a lot of the times when people are saying, well, you know, I think Israel sometimes thinks that it will push, you know, if we keep thinking about Iran, 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 or saying Iran, 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 this will, you know, this will kind of make Saudis start jogging towards their way and getting them. And this is not the case. This is completely wrong. And we've seen this from the Jeddah summit last year when, you know, they've rejected any notion of an anti-air defense alliance and actually collectively extended their hand towards Iran, which led to the normalization.
Between Saudi and Iran.
Between Saudi Arabia and Iran,
right.
Which suggests that this is the Saudi preference of how to deal with Iran, not confronting it. Now, what Israelis are trying to do in the Israeli government is that they're saying Iran this, Iran that, which means that, you know, Saudi is very cognizant of the fact that it doesn't want to be two things, a symbolic border for Iran to constantly and other militias to attack Saudi and in the name of attacking Israel. And secondly, they don't want to be in the middle of any kind of war and get caught up in the middle. And this is something that you could see they tried to diffuse this during the Trump administration when he kind of gave the order to kill Qasem Soleimani. You know, they tried to de-escalate, which suggests that they don't want to be in the middle of this. So there's clearly something that they're not, you know, the way to deal with Iran, a lot of people like to think, yes, okay, they agree that it's a threat. That's fine. But when was the Islamic Republic not, you know, didn't pose a security concern for Saudi? But it's the way they deal with it, which is different.
Yeah, you hear less of that, at least from the Israeli side of late, that we're normalizing with the quote-unquote moderate Arab states, the Gulf, and not just the Gulf. They're trying to form a anti-Iran alliance.
Exactly.
You hear a lot less of that these days. I think even the Israeli officials have come to understand that it's not going to be this black and white issue.
Exactly.
Vis-a-vis Iran. Aziz, final two questions to you, less related to the normalization deal and more related to just the actual view from Riyadh. Number one, I'd love to get a sense of how the Arab world views and thinks about everything happening in Israel over the last 7 months. You mentioned, you know, the judicial overhaul and the scenes coming out of Israel. What does it look like from where you're sitting? There was a quote from a prominent Saudi journalist the other day that made actual headlines in Israel, basically to the effect that Israel finally has turned into a real part of the Middle Eastern landscape, that it's turned into a real Middle Eastern country. What do you make of that comment? And I mean, it was more tongue in cheek, but I guess images of mass anti-government demonstrations and all that. But how much play are the internal Israeli scenes and crisis actually getting traction in a place like Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think I mentioned this also earlier, is that I think what they're viewing, I'm not sure Saudi Arabia or others are overly concerned with the judicial reforms. I think they're concerned with what this could mean. And if this could mean more violence regarding the West Bank, then this is obviously they're going to cover it. I think the way they've covered it, I mean, who in the Arab world are you asking about? So if you look at Al Arabiya, the Saudi-based one, you know, they're very much looking at this and in the Saudi, from the Saudi lens or from the Saudi media, is that, okay, they're following the judicial overhaul. They're mentioning aspects of corruption. You know, they're mentioning aspects of how problematic this could be. And they're following this protest and they're saying, okay, well, you know, this isn't the restful Israel that we always see. This is something very different. Now, in what's interesting in the Saudi perspective is that I don't see it being covered as it did historically. And I'm talking about probably 20 years ago or the framing of it. Because I think there's a security issue, that there was a time when, you know, people here in Saudi, they used to cover it, and it just caused a lot of distress, and it caused a lot of anger, which spilled into kind of security issues of terrorism and recruiting terrorism, etc. So this is one thing. But when you look at, for example, Al Jazeera, who constantly follows this, constantly follows what's taking place in Palestine, constantly follows what's taking place with the comments made by Ben-Gvir, Smotrich, and Netanyahu, and they really follow it. This is obviously clear because it fits with their foreign policy of bandwagoning on Arab sentiments, and this is how they're illuminating the Qatari identity. You know, is by bandwagoning on these Arab sentiments. When then this leads to the third point of Arab sentiments. And I'll just say this, and I'll say it very quietly, quickly. I know Netanyahu said this will end the Arab-Israeli conflict. But I also know that Yehud Barak said normalization with Syria will also end the Arab-Israeli conflict. You know, Menachem Begin probably said that about Egypt. I don't think the Arab-Israeli conflict will ever finish without a Palestinian state. This is on the people-to-people level. And we've seen this, you know, time and again, and it's a shame. You know, it's a shame because, you know, there's a lot of grievances that I don't think people will kind of just easily put to the side.
Right.
And we... So This is the issue. Yeah.
Right. And we saw this just last December during the World Cup in Qatar.
Yes. Yes, exactly. From people that came from the Abraham Accord countries too.
Exactly.
You know?
That Palestine was very, very much a participant in the World Cup, as my Palestinian friends like to say.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. Aziz, final question to you. Give us a sense, if you could, of what life is like in Saudi Arabia these days. Obviously, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, the de facto ruler of the kingdom. He's 37 years old, and he's instituted a slew of far-reaching economic and social reforms that you mentioned earlier. So as a younger or youngish Saudi, how has life changed, if at all, in recent years for you and other Saudis?
Not if at all. It completely changed.
Okay.
You know, it's dramatically different than what it was 10 years ago, you know, what it was in other places. And you could see this, you know, I'll just put it very, very succinctly, is that there is a sense of urgency in Saudi now that people are working, the working culture changed. People don't stop working because they really see this horizon, you know, 2030. It really, you know, it really seeped into people's psychology also. There's a lot of projects taking place. And I remember even sometimes driving through the highway, and I remember saying, I remember this place. There was nothing around here. There was absolutely barren desert. Now it's like and all these buildings and restaurants and everything. So clearly, you know, he had to put these economic reforms, and he had to put them because Saudi wouldn't have survived with the way it was going before. You know, Saudi wasn't, and that's why there was that urgency. And a lot of people are looking at this and saying, wow, okay, you know, he must be so different than than his father, or so different than the past. Because there was a generational, maybe a just different psychology before, where they were saying, okay, you have to invest in a post-oil kind of economy. And I think that was kind of lethargically
mentioned.
But now, no, this is clearly, you know, there's a real significant push for this there, and the people to people changes, people to people exchanging is different. You know, there before you would see sections, and this is not too long ago, this is a few years ago, you know, men's section and women's section in restaurants. Now you don't see that any longer.
Really?
You know, music. You don't see that. This was 3 years ago, you know. But at the same time, just to note, okay, that's Riyadh, that's Jeddah, that's the major cities. You drive a little bit outside, there's still some time left for these things. Saudi's a very big country. You know, this is what people also forget. Saudi's a very big country. And this is what I think, what I like about some of the visions or some of the projects, is that he's trying to bring some of these projects in places that didn't receive much funding or didn't receive much investment. So he's trying to spread out this wealth around the country, and which is very interesting to see this.
Okay. That's great to hear, in terms of just the view from Riyadh itself and from Saudi Arabia itself.
Yes.
And really good to hear your assessment of where this normalization push stands and where it may be going, and the real obstacles, I think, that we touched on over the past hour or so in terms of getting this deal done. I don't think anyone should have any illusions that this will be quick and easy.
Of course.
But
course.
I thank you so much, my friend, and we look forward to having you on again on the podcast to further untangle Middle East politics, Gulf politics, and Saudi Arabia itself. So thank you again.
Yeah, my pleasure, Neri. It's really good to join you, my friend.
It's our pleasure. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks again to Aziz Al-Dashian for his generous time and insights. Also, a special thanks to our producer, Jacob Gilman, and to all of you who support Israel Policy Forum's work, including this podcast. You know who you are. Just remember to subscribe, and as always, thank you for listening.